Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
So welcome to Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Thanks so much for joining us. Chris and I were just talking. I'm working on a book that deals with reliability engineering and programs and planning. And Chris, you wrote a book on reliability engineering management in a whole range. I was aghast at how long the book was. I got it electronically, so I didn't realize how hefty this tome was that you did.
Yeah, I was shocked too when I was writing it. So.
But you covered the idea of an organization and their reliability program to a large degree is how they select what tools and activities and tasks and essentially, how do they make decisions? If I get the gist of your book right, it's not, here's 87 things you have to do every single time. Is that?
No, absolutely. It's more of a mindset, I would argue. And just to get terminology, I'm not big on having terminology which has to be argued infinitum. And so in my book, I call a RAM, a reliability plan, something where it transitions an organization from where it wants to be to where it is to where it needs to be. And I know that you and a good deal of other people would refer to that as a program, which means we're still in furious agreement because the content, I'd argue, we don't differ.
Well, I agree. You know, it was funny. Carl and I were working on a chapter or section of a book this morning, and one of the things that jumped out at me was he had a list of 10 lessons learned about creating a reliability program or a plan to change your organization. And number 4 on the list was safety is always first. And I'm like, you know, I see this way too often. Is we see organizations, they even put it in a nice metal etched plaque on the side of the wall in their visitors' conference room, is quality is number one, or reliability is essential for our success, or, you know, some slogan. Mm-hmm. Yet when you get a corporate briefing or you talk, there's a meeting about corporate, you know, values, or it's the start of a program, or even a requirements document for a new product, I almost always start by flipping to page 57 because I'm more likely to find anything to do with reliability there than on page 1.
That's right.
So is that a mindset thing, the way you're defining it?
As you mean program versus plan?
Well, no, just as where's the priority? Doesn't have to be the full investment, right? It's in balance with other things is the way I approach it. But if reliability is not important, you can't say it's important and then not act that way. Those have to be consistent.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, and there are some basic principles which have stood the test of time, even though time and time again, people ignore them. But Joseph Durand, for example, he referred to that phenomenon as exhortation. And where he said, you know, you'd have leaders or managers who say quality is number one, reliability is number one, but they didn't change the formalized process of measuring and rewarding individual performance. And so, like I think you said this as well many times. If you reward someone to ship on time, then that device will be shipped on time, regardless of what state it's in.
That's right.
And Durand in particular, he said, you just can't, exhortation can't compete with the things you actually reward your people for. And it invariably fails.
Yeah, I don't remember who said it. It was actions speak louder than words. And although I had a boss that he took me on a vendor visit, and we walked in, and he says, so what are our objectives? What are we after? And he goes, well, we want to talk about their quality system and their reliability and how they're doing SPC and a bunch of other stuff. Okay, now I understand why I'm here. That's my area. And we walked in and he said, "Hi, my name's Jim. When are you going to get the cost reduced?" And he must have mentioned cost reduction 80 times in the next 10 minutes.
Yep.
You know, and it was 3 hours later, he says, "Oh, do you have any questions on the quality system here?" I'm like, what? You just beat him over the head for 3 hours on cost reduction. They're not going to listen to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it depends what sort of cost you're talking about. If you're talking about the total cost of ownership, or how much money,
you know where that is.
I know.
No, but it's. If it was total cost and they were sharing on the warranty expenses, for example, or the cost of downtime, for example, it would be a different discussion. Mm-hmm. Yet there's a separation from what I see as a okay or a good reliability program. And it's not how much equipment they got, how many test racks they've got set up. It's not, we do burn in and we do this and we do that. No. I don't think that's a hallmark of a great reliability program or even a good reliability program. But it goes back to that mindset thing. I mean, you can have a bad mindset too, right? You could say, we're just going to talk. We know reliability is important, but we don't want to invest any effort into it because we don't know what to do. Might be the true story. They have a mindset. Yeah, it's important. Okay. It's not a very good mindset. So have you seen a really good reliability program? What sets them apart?
One I talk about a lot is quite an unusual one, and that was – Netflix, because what Netflix does is completely unique to Netflix. It adheres to no known, let's call it traditional standards to reliability assurance. But essentially, they not so long ago they obviously realized they needed to do something about being a reliable, essentially cloud computing company or cloud service provider, and they created a program which randomly deleted. A production instance, and this was done in a controlled environment, so you could see engineers could essentially see this program trying to break the service.
Okay.
And if the service was going to get broken, the engineers would step in, stop, learn what they learned about how that system was going to fail, and then recode it and then try again. And so they kept creating these programs which continually tried to tried to break the service, and that first program was fairly small. And they created another program which took out what they call availability centers, and then they built another program which took out entire geographic areas. We're talking about, for example, the entire east coast of the continental US. And they created all these programs which tried to break the system and also maintain the system. And they actually called these programs. They named them after apes and monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that first program I told you about was called, they called Chaos Monkey. Then the one that took out the availability centers or the availability regions, they called Chaos Gorilla. The one that took out entire geographic areas, they called Chaos Kong, so on and so forth. And
they're going to run out of characters.
That's right. And it became known as the Simian Army. And if anyone's interested, you can really easily Google it. And they even have their own well-designed logo for their Simian Army full of apes and monkeys. And there's a couple of talks and presentations by Netflix engineers on how they use the Simian Army to continually test their service, and continually learn from testing their service, as in testing to try and make it fail.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix is widely regarded as possibly the most reliable cloud computing service. If you look at the amount of data they need to transmit on a daily basis, it really is astounding. And one of the things they don't know is how reliable their system is.
They don't have a measure. They're not saying we're five nines on this particular server. That doesn't seem to be important.
It's not. And they realize that even if you, what's the point of quantifying it? They're not going to stop this whole approach to continual improvement. So they don't even know how reliable they are. Everyone knows that they are very reliable, and it's a it's a mindset. It's a truly unique, non-formulaic, read a textbook and follow the bouncing ball, do this step. It required critical thinking, and
Well, I don't know that it's that new.
Bill, no, it's not.
Bill and Dave at Hewlett Packard said, they advocated build, test, fix. They were making electronics boxes essentially, and test and measurement devices, but electronics boxes by and large. And and I see it in startups today. It's, if I have a failure, we're going to learn something, and we're going to go somewhere else. We're going to use different material. We're going to make it work. What I see though is that reliability is seen as separate from that engineering activity of build, test, fix, of doing a test or a disruption or a lost bit or whatever, and learn what's happening so you can make a robust system like Netflix is doing. But that mindset of learning, I think, is what separates it. Netflix and their approach. It doesn't matter whether they have metrics or not. It's that they have this approach to continuing to learn and improve their system. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, and you once told me something, and it's a quote I use because it resonates with so many people, is that you don't test to pass, you test to learn. And if you don't incorporate what you learn, then it ceases to be learning. It's just an observation. So,
right. Yeah, I've surprised so many people with that. They say, well, we want you to write us a test plan. Well, what are you going to do with it? Well, we need to do these tests so we can sell the product. Well, are you going to use the test to actually improve your product or change anything? You're really late in the program. If you pass all these tests, what does it really mean to your customer? And they kind of shake their head saying, well, I got to fill out the data sheet with something. If we don't pass these tests, we can't put it on there. And it's expected we have to pass these tests. I'm like, well, that's a condition of sale. That's not a reliability test. It's not terrible. Yeah, it's marketing. Whatever. I'm not a marketing guy. We don't do that. But that's a much more difficult thing to put into your operating manual or your product life cycles phase gate review processes. You have to do things so you learn and improve your product.
Exactly. And that's the one common thread I've seen for all good approaches, is that you test or do another activity to learn. And by definition, when you learn, it influences the design of the system. Every good reliability program or plan has that key tenet, core philosophy or ethos. You do something to learn from it, and that learning then influences the design. If any one of those two sort of links are broken, then the reliability program is broken.
Yeah, and there's not everybody's doing clouds, delivering movies and television shows worldwide through a cloud-based system. How would this apply for a printer or a smartphone, if you're developing one of those? Because it's not like, I have an iPhone 6, which is getting a bit, I'm thinking about getting the battery replaced while they're still offering them. I get software updates, but there's a limitation by how much the hardware can improve. And they ask if they can get, fault codes and other things when things go wrong on occasion, but it's not the same as Netflix saying, oh, here's what's going to cause this solder joint to crack, and I need to just redesign it and roll it out. They can't redo my hardware unless it's a recall, essentially. But they can improve their future designs of that. But how do you take the Netflix thing into, a development program? Is it as simple as build, test, fix? Build as many and break them as quick as you can?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, but I think the underlying philosophy still remains. So as opposed to answering your smartphone question straight away, I mean, you and I know that whenever you buy a new model of a car, it's actually 98% of the previous model. So there's
sometimes
a lot of
it's the same exact pieces and under the hood for my old car.
Absolutely. And cars are actually getting less reliable technically these days, but I tend to think it's because we're increasing, putting a lot more functionality into vehicles. Vehicles 20 years ago didn't have GPS navigation systems as part of the functions they provided. So now these cars have got a whole new raft of ways they can fail. But I think we can agree that cars are typically pretty reliable these days. If they break down, typically it's because they weren't maintained or they've somehow been damaged away from their original base baseline. And you and I both know the reason, one of the reasons is because manufacturers learn from the actual manufacturing process itself from the previous model and retain that corporate knowledge and utilize it when they develop the next model. So you're talking about smartphones. I mean, what the biggest issue with smartphone reliability that most people can think of is probably the Samsung Galaxy Note 7.
Yeah, well, was it the Note 7 or Note 8 with the battery fires?
Now I'm double guessing myself. Everyone knows which one we're talking. I thought it was a Note 7, but I'm
now yeah. But it's the one with the. Sure. But there weren't that many batteries that caught on fire, right? There was on the order of 20, I think, that were reported.
But that's right. It's
they got banned from aircraft. They got some bad publicity out of that one.
Exactly, and Boeing had the same issue with its lithium-ion batteries, which we're not entirely sure if they've resolved yet. But that's a separate issue.
Well, they did. You know, I don't know that they actually resolved exactly what was causing the problem, but they created a chamber for it so that if it did catch on fire, it would all be vented outside and wouldn't be a problem. So, well, kind of a mitigation step there. That's probably not that comforting, but that's what it is.
Absolutely. But for smartphones, again, we're not developing a smartphone from scratch.
Right.
Every time a new model comes out, a lot of the architecture is going to be repeated. It's more about how do we cram new functionality into it versus how do we make it more reliable. And so I don't know if there's what the Simian Army, Netflix's Simian Army, is almost the ultimate build, test, fix. It just never stops.
Right.
You can't do that for a smartphone. But that said, you can design more resilient systems. You can design systems which can accommodate hardware faults with software updates. So there are things you can do. And I know you've been involved with this, Fred, too. So you've seen a lot of, across many industries, you've seen how people essentially just need to work at how to learn from
what they've done. Well, there's a big part of that. Yeah, I agree. I define a great program as it's proactive. It's the opposite of that exaltation type stuff. They are very consciously making decisions that have appropriate amount of information for them to make a rational decision concerning the reliability in balance with the cost and time to market and feature set within the product. It's not that we're going to, I almost find it easier to define it by what it's not. It's not we're going to do our last run of prototypes and we'll make sure they pass this suite of stress tests. And if it passes that, it must be good. And then they water those tests down so that they pretty much make sure they pass. That's the epitome of what I would call a bad reliability program.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? It's too late, too little, and it really doesn't help you learn anything. A proactive one is... for this part of the product, we have this new technology. We're doing this new material. We don't know how it fails. That's a reason to go to the lab and characterize it or do the testing or force it to fail to see what happens and how it fails. And do we have margin there? If you don't need to run that style of test, if you already know that material and you've been using it for 2-3 generations of products and it's performed well, well, you don't need to test that. There's better opportunities to learn in other areas. So go to those areas. So it's the proactive piece is that mindset of I need to focus where I need to learn the most is probably a summary of what I mean by a proactive program. And one of the things I found in the studies I did were the all these assessments I've done of different organizations is the two organizations that do the least visible reliability activities like FMEAs, halt tests, environmental chambers, shake bacon tests, you know, stress testing, all of the litany of tests and activities and constructs that we have around reliability engineering, the ones that do the least either do nothing because they don't know what or how to do any of it. They don't know the difference between a halt test and an FMEA, and they really don't care, right? Mm-hmm. They get what they get, and it's pretty random. And the other end of the spectrum is they do very few tests, very few activities, but each one they do has a huge impact.
Right.
And the ones in the middle, they try to do everything, right? So every generation, they add another suite of tests. It's like software development programs that they add another test case, and they never drop test case out. You have to pass every situation that we've ever thought of, even though it mm-hmm. doesn't apply anymore. Nobody goes back and cleans those things up very often, unless you start failing them, of course. Then you have to justify the test as rational. But the groups that spend the most money on reliability and spend the most churn of activity often are so busy they don't have time to actually learn anything from what they're doing. And eventually, some of those organizations realize that, oh, you know, we really learned a lot when we paid attention here, here, and here. Let's do more of that and less of the other stuff that's distracting us. And it evolves into learning organization.
I'm wondering if you're thinking about those organizations which are, for whatever reason, subjected to highly compliance-centric approaches to reliability assurance. That is,
well, the military in particular.
Yeah, well, maybe a few minutes. I was going to say military, but yes, military and governmental contractors. But
yeah, well, you know, and I think it's not a reliability problem. There, it's because the British military have gotten around this by saying you need to make a case. You need to do a reliability case. Tell us why your product is going to be reliable in our application. And they have to work together for that to happen. Instead of saying thou shalt do an FMEA on Tuesday, and then you're going to do an environmental test on Thursday, and then you're going to do a growth test model on Friday, and we're only going to pay you enough for those things, and that's it. And it's no doubt they're not getting anything useful from that. It's crazy. Not to say that, you know, you spent quite a bit of time in the military.
Yes. I mean, yeah, and I'm probably more frustrated than most, as you have been as well. But I've got a question for you. I mean, I've gone into some organization where they said, look, you are here to help us improve reliability and stuff like that, which is all well and good. Mm-hmm. But when you get there, you realize it's some really structural organizational problems, such as one organization I went into. They really couldn't articulate their vision, and they're producing a type of device. Some thought they were creating devices so that they could use and then sell the service that the devices provided. And mm-hmm. others thought, no, we're going to create these devices to sell them to others. So they can provide a service. And so some core underlying principles of how their organization was going to operate were just clearly not resolved. And so I sat down with them and we got to the bottom of what their organizational vision needs to be. And another thing I did is said, okay, well, how do you know if I've been successful once I leave here? Things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know the extent to which you've had to mentor organizations to be better organizations, not just more reliable organizations.
I think that's going to be a subject for many, many more episodes. But everything from silos, a good number of organizations have silos. The tech services group mm-hmm. is focused on getting products repaired and back in the hands of their customers, or replacing them very quickly, or whatever. Other parts of the organization are, you know, in that same organization, were focused on new technology, and they were sheltered from interacting with the customers and field returns because that would distract them from designing their new product. And mm-hmm. Sitting down with a senior vice president and basically chewing him out by doing his customers a disservice by focusing on turnaround speed in his repair shop versus reducing the number of failures. He had all this data. He had all this information. But he refused, essentially, to go over to the R&D team and say, hey, if you fix these things, it would be better than me trying to get another 10 minutes out of my turnaround time. Mm-hmm. And he didn't understand why he should go talk to the reliability or to the R&D group. I just lost it. one organization only their warranty expenses, and it has some leeway in the way warranty can be reported and tracked in financial statements, and they only track the cost of repair parts, not the cost of shipping the units back, not the cost of shipping out a brand new unit to replace the one they just took out, got failed and was taken out of service, not the cost of their technicians, which were required for decommissioning and commissioning the products, and all of the retesting they did once they a technician replaced this compressor, which was really cheap,
right,
which was part of the problem. And then they would spend 2 weeks verifying that it was as good as new. It cost them thousands and thousands and thousands per failure, and they only tracked the $38 replaced compressor. So they completely buried the cost and said, oh, we don't have a reliability problem. We're only spending $50,000 a year on replacements. So it was no big deal. And they had a 50% yeah. field failure rate of this life support system. And you've heard this story before.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it right. doesn't get old, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's – but, you know, and the other side is there's a handful of companies that were a challenge to work with because they were so good at understanding what they needed to do. They were trying to get, you know, just the next small fraction improvement because they knew there was value in that. And
yep.
they were already very, very savvy about what they did and why they did it and when they did it concerning reliability and quality and marketing and pretty much the rest of their business. But it started with a clear vision of what they were trying to do, what they were trying to accomplish, what their life cycle costs really were, and not hiding anything from anybody, on and on and on. Yeah, it can be done. And it's going right back to the first thing you mentioned. It's about a mindset, and it's mm-hmm. it's not the reliability engineer's mindset. Although I believe a handful of people in an organization can really make a change, make things happen. Mm-hmm. It has to be pervasive, though, through the organization to be really successful.
No, I completely agree. And I know we talked about, you know, testing to learn, not just to pass, and then. For the premise of saying you're learning is that it influences the design. I've been to other organizations where I start speaking to people and all the good ideas are within the organization. I mm-hmm. mean, there are plenty of really good ideas at the lowest levels of let's call it hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And it got to the stage where I was talking, you know, the report I wrote was says, here's some things you can do. Oh, by the way, most of these ideas came from your own staff.
Yeah.
So let's not necessarily talk about this. Let's talk about why you can't listen to your own staff or why your staff can't.
Well, you're not from far away and have a strange accent. That's why we can't listen
true.
To
them. That's true. I mean, there's that. There are some people who think, you know, unless who genuinely have superiority complexes, then you can't really do too much about them apart from just hope they just go away. But mm-hmm. there are organizations where you put incredible time and budget pressures on your staff without – and that could be justifiable because you're working in a highly competitive industry, but the end state is that all these good ideas, your employees just don't have the resources to communicate to you in the first place, and even if they did, you don't have the resources to do something about it. And so when you start talking about structurally how you can get your employees' ideas into your best practice, DuPont, when they did their period of introspection in 1986, they classified their transition as becoming a learning organization, which mm-hmm. is exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 1980s, Japanese manufacturing, which was the zenith of quality, I would argue, you had foremen whose every Friday they had to spend time going through all the suggestions that their workers came up with, mm-hmm. and their workers were coming up with so many suggestions, it took him all day, every week to go through them. Mm-hmm. It is a really good, if anyone's interested on YouTube, There's a 1981 or 1980 documentary by NBC called If Japan Can, Why Can't We?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes through the same issues that people who complain about reliability today are complaining about. It's exactly the same. We know what needs to happen. It's a mindset. It's a culture.
Yeah. Do you spend much time in your book going after this mindset thing and how important that is? Because I do remember I went to your book a couple of times for some statistical stuff and some of the more definition things, but I didn't get a sense. I got a sense that it was important, but I think that's where you lead off with the book, if I remember right.
Yes. So I talk, you know, my book, I have five sections. The first one's sort of for people who are just new to the topic and talk about reliability. And the second part is management.
That's it.
And I think they saw it. Yeah, and I've got, you know, I talk chapters dedicated to culture, chapters dedicated to, you know, a bunch of other organizational things. But in that culture chapter, I have a quote from Peter Drucker, who's a well-known management, leader. And it's culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yep.
So you and I can come up with the greatest reliability plan, but the culture doesn't exist to support it or allow it to grow. It's just pointless.
That's right.
But if you have a good culture, the reliability plan often becomes redundant because people are trying to continually improve, and that's what invariably happens. So, yeah, a lot of textbooks, I think, especially for reliability, deal with, you know, the Y-ball distribution up front and all this sort of stuff, and mm-hmm. have half a chapter and three paragraphs at the back dedicated to management just to make sure that they can say they've covered it. But when I wrote mine, and you know, it took me a while to get the structure I wanted right, I decided to put management up front because if you don't understand the culture of the organization, or you don't understand the culture is the most important thing, then it's fruitless. And worse still, if you're a reliability engineer and you have no idea what your organization truly values, and you too are a waste of time, because mm-hmm. all you're going to do is analyze the problems you want to analyze versus ones that the company or the organization needs to benefit from.
That's right.
We've come across plenty of those.
yeah, certainly. Yeah, maybe we should just do a whole episode just on how bad it can be. That'd be fun.
I call them reliability witch doctors.
The witch doctors. Yeah. Let me stick that in my parts count prediction algorithm here, and I'll get you your number in a minute. Yeah. I actually met somebody that there's a consultancy that does nothing but that, nothing but predictions. And they'll support it tooth and nail because it's like a huge part of their revenue. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, all right, fine. All right. Before we dive off into that. So let's ask our listeners, have you seen a great reliability program, or do you recognize more of the stories about how bad it can be? You know, one good place for you to go is to Chris's book. We'll put a links to it in the show note. And what's the title of the book again, Chris? Make sure I get it right, or we get it right.
It's Reliability Engineering and Management. So it's a really complicated one to memorize, but
right.
yeah.
Should be able to find that. And I know it's available on Amazon, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And a handful. In fine retail book outlets everywhere is one way to say it. But you can find it.
I say it's just primarily on Amazon. It's only on Amazon right now. One of the issues I have with textbooks is they never get updated. So I haven't gone to print yet, but because I want to support a structure which itself supports continual improvement. So mm-hmm. I think the ebook's the way to go, at least in the short term.
Okay, that works really well. So you can find it on Amazon, Reliability Engineering and Management, and we'll have a link in the show notes. Your book's also listed up on Ascendo under author books, Ascendo Authors, I think is the subtitle of it, under resources.
I just released a 2018 edition too, which hopefully.
Yeah, I got that. My Kindle complaint said that there's a big update, and we want to make sure you don't want to lose all your notes and stuff like that in it before we update it. So you have to think about it a little bit. They'll give you a warning because of a major update, which I appreciate. Might have to get two copies so that I can update one and keep the other one updated.
AI.
Take notes. So anyway, thanks, Chris, so much. Again, visit us out at reliability.fm. You can find the show notes plus ways to get in touch with us. Let us know what you think. Are you in a great organization, or are you working on trying to become one? What kind of hurdles and obstacles do you see? We'd love to hear from you. Both Chris and I are very interested in this topic, because we know it makes such a huge difference in how well an organization operates. And it's all a lot more fun, too, when it's operating well.
And we can't preach that organizations need to be learning organizations if we ourselves cease learning. So we need to learn about the new trends and new ideas that are coming out all the time as well.
Yeah, very true. All right. Well, with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap it up.
Thank you very much.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.